Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I had to go about it, write it out, and find it myself. And there's some stories I can tell you.
This is the Final Word Cricket Podcast with Adam Collins. More by the year, the future of domestic cricket in England is up for grabs. Operating within a squeezed schedule at the time franchise tournaments are changing the global landscape by stealth, the place of the county championship for many of its participating clubs is complicated like never before. In 2023, journalist Ben Bloom decided to explore these underlying issues by interviewing 100 people in the thick of things. The result is his important new book, Batting for Time, The Fight to Keep English Cricket Alive, which has made headlines across the country at the start of this new season. He spoke with me, appropriately enough, during a county game at the Oval in London. Before jumping into that chat, a word for NordVPN, who we've been working with over the last few months. A virtual private network makes it easier to avoid price discrimination. So if you see a product in another region, you jump onto your VPN through Nord, and that's where you can be. You can access foreign e-stores, apps, online auctions for a far wider selection of items, and one NordVPN account protects up to 6 devices, so no need for separate subscriptions, and it just means you can be where you want to be. So for example, if you want to watch sport in the country that it's taking place but you're stuck behind a paywall, NordVPN will help with that if you have a subscription. Very straightforward to get a plan through us, nordvpn.com/TFW. There is no risk with your 30-day money-back guarantee. All of that information is in the show notes, NordVPN.com/TFW to access your 30-day money-back guarantee. Also, I want to, again, as we said on Storytime over the weekend, welcome back Westfield London and Westfield Stratford City. They're going to be working with us, not just through the daily shows in 2024, but on programs like this as well. So Westfield London, Westfield Stratford City, who've been great supporters of The Final Word, more extra, less ordinary. We'll have plenty more to say about them across the months to come. Right, into the big issues of English cricket we go with author Ben Bloom. It is the Final Word Book Club with Adam Collins. I'm sat at the Oval here in South London on a gorgeous Sunday afternoon, and sat opposite me in front of the old gasometer is Ben Bloom. He's a journalist who's written an excellent book, Batting for Time, The Fight to Keep English Cricket Alive. I sort of cite the conditions here because your book in some ways paints a story of existential angst about domestic cricket. Doesn't quite feel that way when you're here at the Oval, but I suppose that's that it's not this way around the country, and that's part of the story you were telling. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, well, I don't know if people within Surrey like it or not. They probably dislike it, but being described as the Man City of cricket.
Yes.
It's very hard to get away from, when you look at the finances, it's very hard to get away from the fact that Surrey do just bring in so much more money. And that's why, yeah, you're right. Being here looks beautiful, looks glorious. There's a hell of a lot of people in today, and you think, this sport's going pretty well in England, and then you go other places and it's not quite the same picture.
So we have about half an hour together, so we'll try and get through as much of this as we can. But, you know, all of this history, over 150 years, the 124th season of the county championship as we know it, I'm pretty sure I'm right in saying, but you've chosen to focus specifically on one year, 2023. I guess there's always that tension about cricket always dying, isn't there? You go back 100 years and people were saying that cricket was dying, but it's felt more acute in the last few years, especially with domestic cricket in England, with the configuration of it. Was that the inspiration for you choosing last year to interrogate in greater depth?
Yeah, it's the spread of franchises, franchise leagues worldwide, because that has completely changed the global face of cricket, really. And then how English cricket responds to that, i.e. they create the 100. And not only do they create the 100, but then it's almost certain that in the next few months, private investment is going to come into the English game through the 100. So those two things, the creation of a non-county tournament and private investment into those teams, completely changes everything that the county game has looked like for 100 to 150 years. So I think that's why, that's the catalyst for why this is so different to previous financial crises that have, like you say, flared every few decades for the last 100 or so years.
It feels like there's a lot up for grabs at the moment around this time. Yes, franchise cricket,
the proliferation of tournaments around the world, but also the concentration of ownership and how that conflicts with how we're conditioned to seeing players progress and playing domestic cricket. And that's why we're at sort of a hinge point right now.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you've got the whole hierarchy of cricket is really changing. You know, we've had throughout the whole of cricket's existence, international cricket has sat at the top. Undisputed. It's been the most important form of cricket. And now, so you've had international and you've had domestic. Suddenly you've got franchise, and franchise is way, way, way above domestic. It's up there challenging international. Mm. A lot of people would say it's above international now. Where does that leave domestic? Suddenly it was the second tier. Now it's a way, way, way distant third tier.
And specifically the primacy of 18 first-class counties. I mean, you read the Strauss report, there's no talk of killing counties or anything like that, although people might interpret some of the measures as related to it. But nevertheless, we often hear that the stated aim is to keep 18 counties. But is there a quiet bit not being said there? Is there a subtle bit that we're meant to read between the lines?
Yeah, so everyone at the ECB, on the record at least, and you know, off the record to me, has firmly stated they do not want to see any counties disappear. I believe them because I think they do have cricket's best interest at heart. But they believe that there should be a smaller elite. And they sort of want to create a two-tier structure within the county game. So they want 6 to 8 top Surreys, basically.
Yep.
They want the best players there. They want to bridge the gap between the county game and the international game. And they see that as the best way to do it. Now, by extension, that will then diminish the power of the remaining counties. Now, they don't want those counties to die, but they want to concentrate the talent elsewhere. So they will become second-tier entities.
Yeah, it's a nice frame for the rest of our conversation, that really, because you look at the different ways that counties set up at the moment, the three that are privately owned, Durham being one of those. You had Tim Bostock, the chief executive, pretty punchy comments to you that made headlines describing county members as a small number of Luddites, and the way in which, I think what he was trying to say, and I'm keen for your perspective on this, is that a relatively small number of people, i.e. county members, have an enormous amount of control over the direction of cricket, which does seem unusual in a modern world. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but it does seem, when we think about the way other sports are run, this is a kind of a quirk, that there'd be a even smaller number, again, of active members who dictate the fortunes of each club.
Yeah, definitely. In the book, Tim Bostock, I think he approximates a figure of about 10,000 people that wield this power. Now, where that number is from is, I used 2022 membership data. There were 69,000 fully paid adult county members. Mm-hmm. So they are the people that essentially own the clubs. Now, actually, as you said, 3 of the 18 are not member-owned, so that takes out about 8,000 of those 69,000. So you're at 61,000. How many of those 61,000 take an active interest, i.e. go to the forums, vote in the AGMs, all of that type of thing? Probably around 10,000. That might actually be over-egging it. It might be a lot less. Now, those 10,000 people are of a very particular demographic. They tend to be from a very particular standpoint. They are traditional, entrenched in their ways, and they don't at all represent a breadth of the audience that enjoys cricket in England. And so I think it is out of kilter to have those 10,000 approximately sort of determining what the future of English cricket is going to look like, when nowadays far, far, far more people watch the 100 or watch the T20 Blast and that type of thing, and they don't vote in the AGMs. So how can they, how can those people, the white ball specialists, for example, how can they have more of a say in the future of the game? Because currently they don't.
Right. So as the economy evolves, or it's almost like revolution, not evolution, with the way modern cricket feels and looks year on year, that there's this, so I think you described it as a Victorian model, a Victorian era model, and we're trying to almost retrofit what we've got now into that, and that's where there are these discrepancies, where these perspectives are difficult to resolve.
Yeah, because if you were creating a structure nowadays, I don't think you would have 18 counties. You would probably do what the ECB are trying to do. You would have a smaller elite, and then you would have a second cohort of almost feeder counties. And I think that's what they want. They would also probably not have them member owned. Now, that is a major sticking point, because member ownership sort of creates a layer of strength that if you have private ownership, that you're just at the behest of one person, whoever owns it. Whereas if you have the community owning it, in theory, it gives them more power to not be so beholden to market forces and the whims of one person.
Well, that's it, isn't it? I mean, you can only sell an asset once.
Yeah.
You can't. It's very difficult to bring something like a sporting club back into the ownership of fans. You sometimes see it in football where clubs try and become fan-owned again, having had bad experiences with private ownership and trusts that come in and that kind of thing. So, I mean, it seems too simplistic for me to simply say that if clubs were privatised, then they'd be automatically in a better position.
Yeah, it's a real tricky one, because if you look at rugby union and you look at football, privately owned clubs go to the wall all the time.
Yeah.
They disappear. Now, the 18 first class counties, they haven't always been first class for over 100 years, but most of them have. None of them have died. They've all survived throughout all of these financial problems that invariably crop up. They've always survived. That isn't the case in privately owned football and rugby. So therefore, why would cricket want to go down a privately owned route? That's one argument. The flip side is, I spoke to CEOs at some of the smaller counties, and I quote them in the book, Gloucestershire and Worcestershire, for example, and they've said, we can't financially continue like this for 5 to 10 years without private investment. The finances just don't add up anymore, and they can't see another route through it other than private investment.
Interesting that, you know, as the product's being talked down in different ways, that there would still be a market for private ownership in county clubs. Like, the rational part of the brain would suggest that they would be a bad buy, but whenever there's been discussions in the last 6 months, especially around where clubs might end up, what the ownership structure might be, it seems like there's a surplus of prospective investors ready to roll.
Well, yes. Yes and no.
Okay.
So I spoke to Rod Bransgrove at Hampshire, and he obviously took them over 20-odd years ago when Hampshire was on its knees, and he's turned them into this really strong, prosperous, financially sound county. And he said, yeah, there's loads and loads of investors globally that want to invest in Hampshires and Surreys and Lancashires and Yorkshires and places like that. But who is going to invest in Gloucestershire and Worcestershire and Derbyshire and those types of places? It's probably going to be the successful local businessman in that town or city, which is fine, but it's not we're not talking the realms of an IPL franchise, that type of thing. So again, who's going to invest in these counties? There is almost a two-tier investment type model. There's going to be these massive franchises or multinational corporations that want to buy into the big counties. You can't see them wanting to plough money into a Worcestershire who can't even play at their home ground because it's sadly flooded so much.
Feels like that. What's that? The guy who goes bankrupt, slow at first and then very quickly at the end. Like with this, with county cricket, I'm acknowledging what I said before about there always been this angst around the sustainability of it. Until very recently, the reputation of county cricket was outstanding. I mean, where did the West Indies players come when they were the best team in the world? They played their first-class cricket here. The Australians of the 1990s and 2000s likewise. Even last year, before the Ashes, what does Steve Smith do? Number one ranked batter in the world came here. Marnus Labuschagne, you know, Nathan Lyon's here at the moment, Chiteshwar Pujara, Kemar Roach playing out here in this game, Shah Masood, Pakistan's captain. So the actual cricket itself, when they're on the park, players still want to actually be here.
Oh yeah, definitely. It's, you know, Alex Stewart spoke about this so well after Surrey won the county title last year, about saying that everyone aspires to be here. This is the best domestic Red Bull competition globally, but it still just doesn't pay the bills. And in this franchise world, obviously all those brilliant cricketers that you mentioned are here, but so many aren't, and fewer are going to come here if they can get franchise gigs elsewhere. This will be a secondary option to them. You know, if Pujara could get an IPL gig, I'm sure he'd be playing IPL cricket, wouldn't he?
And pondering about the competitive balance between the counties, you know, the Man City of county cricket with Surrey and so on, but it isn't that long ago that, like, Essex were a powerhouse and they're not considered to be a super rich county. And Somerset finished in the top 2-4 seasons out of 5, I think it was. Again, we're not talking about a test-playing, air quotes, test-playing county either there. So it doesn't feel like it's taken long to move from, well, you know, yes, all 18 counties can't win it each year. There's two divisions anyway. But maybe Division 1, you can see a path to victory for six or seven of them, whereas now at the start of a new season, really, we think maybe at best two or three could realistically win come September.
Yeah, well, Surrey should win.
Right, yeah, on paper, right.
They should just win on paper,
but still.
Essex and Somerset are the two interesting ones because they are the two that, you know, you look this year and they do have very real aspirations to win the county title this year and every year, but they're not 100 counties and they don't host international cricket. And I think the 100 is the key because through not having a 100 county, through not being a host county and therefore receiving this investment that is going to come, not having a stake to sell in those 100 franchises, it's going to hit Essex and Somerset. And maybe I'm sort of doom-mongering, but I can't see them being as strong in 5-10 years once that money comes through the system and the host counties that have 100 teams get to use that money. I can't see how Somerset and Essex can stick with them.
Yeah, there's a concentration of wealth, right? And we often on this podcast talk about it in the international context, use that 5-10 year window that you're referring to before. Like, what does international cricket look like in 5-10 years due to the power of franchise cricket and the way that that radically changes the price signals for players? It's only rational for players to want to maximise their earnings on the way through. We've seen it already affect domestic cricket. The one example that's always raised is Will Smead, but there'll be other players like that who into the future will see a better life and a better world, not going down the traditional path. And the 100's right in the middle of this as well, isn't it? I mean, you've spoken to 100 people for this book in the early years of the 100 competition as well, but the haves and the have-nots, right? I mean, the ability for a club to be as competitive in four-day cricket when they don't have the 100 infrastructure, i.e. that extra revenue stream, it just gets tougher than it already is for clubs who've been, in a lot of cases, in Division 2 for an awfully long time.
Yeah. Like you say, there are a lot of counties that have been mired in Division 2 for quite a while, basically since the two-division structure came in. And that is their natural place in the ecosystem. But that gap is growing hugely, at a really rapid rate in recent years. And the 100 is a key part in that. You know, hosting international cricket has always been a key thing. The stadium that you play in and the other revenue streams. We're at Surrey and they make something like 26 or 29 million a year just through off-field activities. Mm-hmm. Now, there are half a dozen counties that their income per year is around £5 million full stop. That's everything. Now, Surrey's 29 just for off-field. And then that doesn't even include hosting all the international games and the 100 and all the other different things. So there are loads of different factors to it. But yeah, the 100 is only making that divide grow.
Yeah, and what you can do with that money, right, when it's sort of graduated privilege over years, what a better place you're in. But you know, then I think about when clubs have gone under before. The best example I have in my world, being from Melbourne, is when the Fitzroy Football Club went under in 1996. Yes, they merged, if you want to be technical about it, but effectively went out of business and were taken to Brisbane. And you know, there are people who live their lives and identify with these clubs who ride the bumps year in, year out, who buy their membership, or maybe they don't, but the club, the spirit of the club courses through their veins. The idea of having had this forever, and then maybe having, as you say, six Surreys and 12 can sort themselves out and be some version of the minor counties, that is going to have a far wider effect on people and proper cricket people and lifelong cricket people than maybe it's even being talked about.
Yeah, well, I tried to speak to as many of that type of person in the book, as well as speaking to the CEOs and the chairman and those types of people, but also the members, the people that have put their heart and soul and money into the county game for so long. And they see the county game not in any way as a business. And a lot of them don't see it in any way as a fight to win. They see it as a community-owned, community-focused asset that is there to serve them and to bring people together. The social aspect of the game is so big. It's not like football, which is a 90-minute game. Mm. It's a four-day game, and it occupies 6 months of the year. And going back to working out who should have the biggest say, I spoke to Paul Farbrace down at Sussex, and he said, well, these are the people that, you know, during COVID, they carried on paying their membership fees, even though they couldn't go and watch it, because that's how much they care about the game. they deserve a bigger say than everyone else. And there's definitely a valid argument to that.
So it does kind of feel a bit crude when Rod Bransgrove in your book speaks about, you know, the free market spitting out what the free market spits out. Like, it disregards those people. Mm. Now, my football club nearly went under in 1996 as well, I hasten to add. I mean, had that happened, I wonder how different my life would be as a journalist or as a whatever I do now, but as a human, what it means to me. And I'm very aware of that in all of this. Like, we can get quite fixated on what county cricket represents in relation to how strong the England men's team are when they go to Australia every fourth year, and forgetting that this is a competition all of itself, and it's been going for an awfully long time, and we have a duty to take care of it with that in mind too.
Yeah, definitely. The people that come and watch county cricket, they do it for the love. They do it because it's in their blood and it's been with them for years, decades, and they're not bothered about the finances, and a lot of them aren't bothered about growing and trying to fight against the Surreys and that type of thing. But they don't have to worry about that. That's the thing. There are people that do have to look in their wallets, and so to speak, and realise that there's absolutely nothing in there.
Yeah, and look, and that's the job about in the book you refer to the next 100 years, and how do you lay a foundation to still be here well after we're all gone? And in a way, that my favourite chapter of the book is when you spoke to Sean Jarvis at Leicestershire, because, you know, they are seen as the quintessential Division Two battlers. I know they won the Metro Bank Cup last year, and that's a stunning story, and they've actually improved quite a bit as a Red Bull team in the last couple of years. But you look at it over the last 20 or 30 years and where they've, well, 20 years, and where they've mostly been at the bottom of Division 2. But he's like, no, we don't just want to survive at Grace Road. We want to thrive. We want to innovate. We want to try and find a different way. Mm. I mean, if that plays out in the way that he wishes, that could be the model for other counties. Inspiration might be drawn from that.
Yeah, so it's about trying to find purpose for these smaller counties. So the counties that host international cricket and have 100 franchises attached to them, their purpose is there already, really, because they're feeding the international ecosystem and the franchise ecosystem. But the smaller counties, if they're not producing players for England and they're not affecting the 100, what is their purpose? And so Sean Jarvis, the CEO at Leicestershire, has tried to come up with a new purpose, because he knows he can't compete against the big guys. He knows he can't just build a 20,000 seater stadium. So he's come up with this idea. The Academy of Cricket is what he calls it. And he sees what Leicestershire do on the pitch as an Academy of Cricket, i.e. we give players a chance to come through. And then, if they go on to Nottinghamshire, as it invariably is.
As they usually do.
Yeah, or whoever else, then so be it. They've learnt what they learnt at Leicestershire, and Leicestershire therefore has a purpose. And what Sean wants to do is extend that Academy of Cricket model off the pitch as well to the academic side.
Right.
And he wants to create a qualification in whatever form, an MBA type thing, to learn the cricket admin side of things. And that sounds a bit odd, but that exists quite extensively in the world of football. So you can go to various universities and learn how to become a football director. He wants to do that in cricket. Now, whether there's enough demand to then actually employ those people that will gain that qualification, I don't know. I personally have some doubts over that, but he's thinking, he's trying to work out how to give Leicestershire purpose.
Yeah, how to have a crack at doing it in tough circumstances. I mean, Ash Giles at Worcester, as you mentioned, their ground, the dramatic sort of climate change effect on, well, I'm putting two and two together, but, you know, the way that flooding has increased and thus the unavailability of new road, but going through that cycle, promotion, relegation, I mean, it must over time just wear clubs down when they know they're good enough to get out of Division 2 but not to necessarily compete in Division 1. There's that friction there too.
Yeah, well, it's really hard for Worcestershire. Like you say, they're the ultimate yo-yo team. They just don't seem to be able to survive in Division 1. We'll see if they do this year. It'll be some achievement if they do, though, because they just really struggle to compete. Their finances are just so tight, and they don't even have a ground that they can play on half the time. They're the only ground, or half the time at the moment.
Sorry, yes.
Doing them a disservice. But they're the only ground that doesn't have fixed floodlights. They don't have an indoor facility, so their players can't practice there. They go down to the nearest public school, which sort of speaks volumes about cricket in England.
Sure. Public for our Australian listeners means private over here.
Yes, sorry, public, private. Yeah, so life down there for Ashley Giles is really hard. And that's why he was one of the people that said he doesn't see a route through without private investment. He didn't say it in so many words, right. I would like to add, but he sort of implied it.
And there's the alternative view, isn't there, that some would advance that, well, if this happens this way, we would rather be a minor county. I mean, it sounds crude, but if you can't be Hampshire, if you're not going to have an entrepreneur step in and build you a ground and force you to test playing status and 100 status and all the rest of it, if that's just not viable for your club, thinking Gloucester here, they've done such a great job, Gloucester. You know, I go down there to Bristol and you see what they've done in terms of trying to make the club more than what it is off the field and the work they've done with the BAME communities and so on. But nevertheless, the parlous financial situation they find themselves in. Like a club like that, if the choice was becoming a minor county or having to do something extreme just keep the doors open, that'd be a debate.
Yeah, well, Will Brown, down to the CEO at Gloucestershire, he's gone down the extreme route. So they've announced that they're looking to develop a new stadium on the outskirts of Bristol because they really want to develop. They want to attract 100 franchise. He was the one that did actually say, quite bluntly, that he thinks they will have to go down the private investment route. So that's the way he sees things.
Okay.
But then if you were to speak to loads of the Gloucestershire members, and I think it's the members really that would argue against that, they would say, well, we just don't want it. We don't want the 100. We don't want private investment. We want a member-owned club. And we don't really care. Not we don't care, but if we do become a minor or national county, we can accept that. We would rather have that. That's preferable to being privately owned.
And heard from Andrew Strauss during the week on TalkSport saying that he just doesn't get what the fuss is all about when it comes to criticism of the 100. I don't know, is there a bit of hive mind going on here too up at ECB Towers where they can't quite grasp at some deeper level why people are resistant to this sort of revolutionary change that might be required somewhere here? Like there's missing pieces here in the conversation?
I think everyone at the ECB understands where it comes from, and I think they probably think the same as Tim Bostock, but they would never say it.
Right.
They would see the people that fight against it as being close-minded and looking at it from a very small micro perspective instead of looking at the bigger picture. And the ECB themselves are looking at the bigger picture and these members are looking at it from a very small perspective. That's their argument.
As we have to wind down our conversation, I regret to say, because we're nearing lunch here and you've got other interviews to get to, but I mean, what do you actually think will happen? This is the $64,000 question, right? Like we know what might happen in 5 to 10 years, but you've been doing this. This has been your life's work for the last 12 months writing this book, which I'm sure will become award-winning in the fullness of time. What do you think domestic cricket in England will look like? Let's pick a decade from now in 2034.
I think there will be a de facto Premier League, and it might even become a proper Premier League. Smaller, concentrated elite with 6 to 8 counties. That's what the ECB want. That's what the Strauss Review had, really. It didn't call it a Premier League. So at that point, it was a de facto. But I think if the gap grows as big as I suspect it will financially, there just won't be a lot of point in Surrey playing Derbyshire or Lancashire playing Gloucestershire because they're just fighting on completely different planes. So you may as well have a Premier League. So that's in Red Bull terms. I suspect there will be a Premier League in Red Bull terms. I also suspect that white ball competitions will be like the FA Cup in football, where everyone can have a crack. And that's the chance for the smaller teams to win something.
Right, which is kind of what we see at the moment, right? Where the blast is more volatile than...
Yeah, yeah. So I suspect that's what will happen. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if one or two counties fell by the wayside.
You can tell you've written this from a position of love and respect and care. It's very clear in the pages. It's not polemic. It's not you trying to argue one corner or another. You must feel kind of drained by the end of it, being a county cricket lover, knowing that what you're writing in some ways. Or maybe it'll be seen as a challenge. Maybe when people pick up this book and administrators pick up this book and maybe even private owners who pick up this book, they might see this is right. This is the hurdle we need to clear, and we've got a very limited amount of time left to get over the top of it.
I think everyone would benefit. God, that's such an arrogant thing to say about your own book, isn't it? But I think everyone would benefit from reading it. Just seeing different perspectives, basically, because it's very easy to live in an echo chamber, certainly on social media, and only hear from people that think the same as you. So I think people would benefit from hearing other viewpoints. I'm a Sussex fan, and so researching and writing this book and then sort of drawing the conclusions that I have done paints a very gloomy picture for a club like Sussex. So it's but from a personal perspective, it's quite upsetting because 20 years ago, my county was winning 3 titles in 5 years, and I can't see us ever winning the county championship ever again if what I am suggesting does actually play out. So let's hope I'm wrong.
Well, I'm happy to say it. Everyone who cares about English cricket should read this book. It's called Batting for Time, The Fight to Keep English Cricket Alive. Ben Bloom, congratulations on the work. It's vital work, and thanks for joining us on The Final Word today.
Thank you. So you know what I meant here. I had to go.